On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. George Bush is in Europe for this year's big G8 meeting of industrialized nations. The Germans are running the meeting. At the heart of the agenda, doing something big and urgent about global warming. After all the talk, this is where the rubber meets the road, or misses it. Before Air Force One even revved up for the flight, the White House said no way to European plans for controlling greenhouse gases. President Bush says he has a plan of his own. Critics say he's a staller, a backpedaler, an underminer, but we're playing for all the marbles now. Up next on Point, Bush versus Europe on the planet's future. Joining me first today from London is Leila Bolton. She's assistant world news editor for the Financial Times. She's been keeping a close eye on preparations for the G8 summit. Leila, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
These leaders have all gathered in Germany. How close to the top of the agenda does the environment remain with everything else going on with Russia and you name it?
Well, at the moment, I think everything is drowned out by the Cold War style rhetoric we've been hearing for the last 2 days. When, however, the leaders really get down to the nitty-gritty, which is tomorrow, then I think we can expect some substantive discussion on climate change, which, after all, is the most cherished agenda item of Angela Merkel, the summit host.
Remind us of the byplay in advance of this meeting. Germany has put up a great big plan. The White House, the U.S., essentially said no way before they ever arrived, and President Bush put up a plan of his own?
Well, Angela Merkel, the German chancellor, wants the leaders to agree a stabilization goal at this week's summit aimed at preventing global temperatures from rising by more than 2 degrees. This implies stringent cuts in carbon dioxide emissions, and therefore are rather specific in nature. President Bush has countered with what he says is not a rival plan, but something that will feed into international discussions on a treaty to replace the Kyoto Protocol, which expires in 2012 and famously has not involved the U.S. So really the question is, can the leaders this week agree a form of words which will take the G8 in the specific kind of direction Germany and many of its European partners, including Britain, are looking for?
Leila, what response has President Bush had even before he arrived? I saw in your maybe German counterpart there, the Handelsblatt newspaper in Germany, headline, Bush torpedoes Merkel's climate plans. We saw this comment from her environment minister, Sigmar Gabriel, warning that President Bush's plan might prove to be a Trojan horse that would disrupt more than it led. But overall, is it possible to characterize European response?
Well, I think there's certainly a great deal of skepticism, although Tony Blair, for instance, who sees himself as a master at building bridges between the U.S. and Europe, will certainly make a very big effort this week to try and bring together these seemingly separate positions. The White House is assuring European governments that it is not in the business of torpedoing the main United Nations discussions on an international treaty. So I think there is, again, a lot of rhetoric, but what will really count is what leaders discuss when they are sitting behind closed doors. After all, President Bush will be committing his successor to a program of radical emission cuts if he agrees anything. So actually, there's a lot less for him to lose in agreeing something now than, say, a couple of years ago.
Mm. Leila Bolton at the Financial Times in Washington, watching that G8 summit getting underway in Germany. Leila, thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Joining me now in the studio is Robert Stavins. He's one of the country's leading authorities on environmental policy and economics, professor of business and government at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, director of the Harvard Environmental Economics Program. His new book coming out in September is Well, couldn't be more appropriate. Relevant Architectures for Agreement, Addressing Global Climate Change in the Post-Kyoto World, and we're nearly there. Robert Stavins, thanks very much for joining us.
Pleasure to be here, Tom.
And with us from London is Emma Duncan, deputy editor of The Economist magazine. She's author of the magazine's special report this week on climate change, headlined Cleaning Up. Emma, thanks very much for being here.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Let me go first to you, Robert Stavins. What do you see in this apparent fork in the road between the U.S. and Europe? Do we have, it's been described as a game of chicken. Are we going in different directions? Are these contradictory? Do they somehow meld together? Do we have, I guess the essential question is, the leaders of the industrialized world getting onto a track that will effectively address climate change, global warming?
Well, the premise I'd start with is that global climate change is a serious threat and that it's a global commons problem, so individual countries can't deal with it because the benefits to any given country are always going to be less than the cost of taking action. So we need an international approach. Now, some people, in particular our European allies, think the Kyoto Protocol was an excellent first step. Obviously, this administration is skeptical of that. But what everyone would agree to is that a second step is required, essentially for the year 2012. The president's come forward with a proposal. I think the proposal that he's come forward with in terms of the level of detail, which is slim at present, has both good news and bad news associated with it. The good news is essentially, first of all, that this is the first time this administration, in particular this president, has actually stated, has signaled engagement with allies on developing a post-Kyoto international climate policy architecture.
That's movement.
That is definitely movement, and it's important movement. And in particular, he's also said that he wishes to do it with what he characterized as the 15 leading countries that represent 85% of the emissions, instead of dealing immediately with the 175 to 190 countries you deal with in the Kyoto context.
So 15, that's the G8, which is Europe, the U.S., Japan, Russia, plus China, India, what, Brazil, Mexico, that tier of player?
That's correct. China, India, Brazil, South Korea, Mexico is the G8 plus the 5.
Mm-hmm.
And then he's also throwing in Indonesia, and probably Australia is in there as well.
And remind us of what the president's proposing again?
So what he's proposing is that group, the G8 plus 5, is the ones where the initial discussion should be. And first of all, that's an approach that was recommended by former Prime Minister Paul Martin in Canada. Tony Blair has been recommending that approach. A lot of climate experts have been recommending that approach.
But he's saying, and we'll come to more of the good and bad news that you see in this, but to understand just what he's proposing, he said we're going to sit down starting soon.
We're going to sit down and we're going to have a series of discussion among the world leaders and their seconds in order to map out, first of all, a set of long-term global emission targets.
Long-term means what in this case?
Well, in this case means 10, 20, 30, even 40, 50 years out.
Okay.
And that happens to be appropriate for this long-term stock environmental problem, to think in terms of those long-term approaches.
But these are targets. This is not a mandate he's talking about.
He has not been specific on that.
Mm-hmm.
He's also said that individual countries then would have to decide how they're going to comply, what they're actually going to do. This is where you would begin to get into what I would become more concerned about, which is what are the actual actions, the actual instruments of public policy that will provide the mandates
for action.
Is it
for real or is it rhetoric and plans that don't get fulfilled? Emma Duncan in London, let me turn to you for a moment here. How is this being received in Europe? President Bush doesn't exactly have an aggressive track record on the environment. So do Europeans now look at this and say, bravo, or wait a minute, George?
Well, up to a point. They say bravo to the extent that, as Robert's saying, you know, for the first time we're hearing something from the American presidency that sounds like action. So bravo that he's saying anything at all. Bravo, I think very broadly, that he is trying to involve India, China, the other big developing country emitters, because that's got to be done at some point. The area where people aren't saying bravo is his failure, again, to countenance the idea of any sort of cap on American emissions, because over in Europe, where we already have a cap and trade system, the feeling is that the world is going to get nowhere on this until the Americans agree to adopt something similar.
Bob, without a cap on emissions, is it all just hand-waving?
The first step that has to take place in order to get together is literally just to get together, and then in order to have a discussion. And then, in fact, it will be necessary to have mandates, to have a cap.
President is not signaling that yet, is he?
He is not signaling that, and that's what I would call the bad news here. In fact, even worse than that, from the White House at the same time the president made his announcement. White House staff then answered questions from the press, mm-hmm. and they explicitly said that the administration continues to oppose both a domestic cap and trade and an international cap and trade program, and that's very bad news. On the other hand, we should recognize a cap and trade program is coming. We're going to have one in the United States. It's not going to be coming out of this Congress.
Who says?
It's clear from what's happening in the Congress that the Congress following this one will pass the legislation.
Five bills already up on the rails.
Exactly. And the only reason we're not going to get them this time is, I think, for political reasons, it's not clear the Democrats really want to vote out a bill for the president to sign.
Emma Duncan, let me ask you. Your magazine ran an editorial this week saying without a cap on emissions, everything is just a joke. It won't really happen, and business cannot plan for the future in which its emissions are likely to be constrained somehow. If President Bush doesn't agree to that, are Europeans going to feel stymied for now? Are they willing to get into this conversation if it doesn't come with a guarantee that there's a cap out there?
Well, I think they will feel stymied. I think the Europeans are pleased to get any sort of engagement with the American administration. But as Robert says, we need a cap. In terms of materially having any effect on this, we do need a cap. There is an assumption in Europe, and increasingly an assumption in business, even in America, that a cap is coming. And so, if we can have the administration engaged, it can only help further the process. Mm.
Let's hear President Bush in his weekly radio address on Saturday talking about his plans for curbing harmful emissions and reining in global climate change.
Under my proposal, by the end of next year, America and other nations will set a long-term global goal for reducing greenhouse gases. And to meet this goal, we must help developing countries harness the power of technology. The United States is investing billions of dollars in clean energy technologies and coming up with new ways to share these technologies with other nations. Through the spirit of innovation, we will help developing nations grow their economies and be responsible stewards of the environment.
Sounds good, but Hans Verloom, the climate director for the World Wildlife Fund, said the White House has blocked productive global talks on climate change and that he's skeptical of Bush's effort now.
I think this is more a diversion than a conversion. And moreover, the process that the White House is proposing is actually casting a long shadow over the climate process that the UN has started.
And then in an interview with German television over the weekend, Angela Merkel, Germany's leader, said talks on climate change at the G8 summit should not result in any sort of what she called lazy compromise now that Bush has brought a plan to the table.
Also, ich habe den Umweltminister nun sehr genau verfolgt, was am Wochenende gesagt hat. Und hat
there
gesagt,
it is for all you German speakers, but she's saying anybody who thinks that the European commitment, a demanding commitment to change, is going to be eclipsed by other plans may be disappointed. I want to turn to Germany right now and the chief climate advisor to Chancellor Angela Merkel. Hans-Joachim Schellnhuber is with us. He's founding director of the Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Research. Mr. Schellnhuber, thanks very much for joining us.
Hello.
Please give us your view on President Bush's plans outlined last week that he's bringing to Germany, has brought to Germany right now. Can these work together with what Chancellor Merkel envisions, or is there a problem here?
I think this is a very welcome move by the United States president, actually, because we were afraid a little bit that the whole discussions about long-term goals for global climate protection might be blocked in the preparation phase of the negotiations now. But it obviously is true that now the United States are willing, in a sense, to move forward, to make progress within an international framework. And most welcome is the sign that the United States might want to resume global leadership in a problem which is probably the most important one in the 21st century. As when it comes to the small print, so to speak, of President Bush's proposal, we simply have to see what will emanate from the discussions we're having this week.
So take us to the bottom line here in these conversations. What will decide whether they can, Merkel and Bush, let's say, can join hands and say we have a way forward, or what's a deal breaker? President Bush so far has not been willing to commit to a cap on greenhouse gas emissions. If he doesn't say yes to that, will Merkel say, no, this doesn't work?
I mean, there are two ways of sort of concluding the talks this week. One way certainly is that one agrees on several essential points, and I'll come to that in a minute. The other alternative is clearly that one agrees to disagree on some really important things. So when it comes to the essential points, actually, there are some, if you like, red lines for the German government. For the German government, it's clear that we need something like a long-term orientation towards climate protection, and that should be something substantial, and hopefully we will get some numbers. The second big thing is that the process in the end has to be organized by the United Nations. So whatever the United States are proposing, it is important that this is complementary and supporting the United Nations process and is not deviating anybody from that. The third point is that, and I think that is really the lowest hanging fruit in the overall negotiation, mm-hmm. we need to do something on efficiency, energy efficiency. That is actually at the focus of the German presidency, but has been overlooked, I guess. That's where we certainly can strike a deal, and we would expect the United States to come on board. So there is hope that we make progress on these essential points. If the language is not satisfying everybody in the end, when this is realpolitik, as we say in German, real politics, of course, there you always have to compromise. But Germany will not compromise on certain issues like a long-term orientation, and if we cannot agree in Heiligendamm on something really important, and if an agreement would only water down, actually, the climate protection ambitions, when there will be a disagreement, of course. But I think there is a lot of hope still, and my feeling is that behind the scene there's a lot of movement now, so I'm still optimistic.
Emma Duncan, what do you think of this German view? Do you see the likelihood of all these leaders being prepared at the end of this meeting to hold hands and say we're on the same page, given how much kind of higher profile global warming has had with European governments than with this administration?
Well, I think the crucial point made there, and the really interesting one, is the question of whether America wants to get back into this issue and assume global leadership of it. And if that's what Mr. Bush's comments have indicated, then I think that's really promising. One thing that I suspect would be a stumbling block is numbers. I don't think America will go in for numbers at this stage. So I think it's entirely possible that we can have an agreed positive statement, certainly one looking at long-term goals, because those are the terms, obviously, that America is looking at this into. I would be very surprised if at this stage America was prepared to put numbers, either temperature numbers or emissions numbers, on its aspirations at the moment.
But let me ask you, with all the gap that's been there for so long now, particularly with this president, does Europe have enough confidence in the United States on this issue to hand leadership on the global warming question to the USA?
Look, this president isn't going to be there very long. America has to take leadership of this issue because America is utterly crucial to the whole thing, not only because it's the world's largest emitter, but because unless America takes leadership of this issue and involves itself very seriously in the politics of it, there is no way that India and China are going to make any sort of commitment. There's no reason why they should.
Robert Stavins, so give us take us further down the rosy scenario path here. If this works out, and we pray that it does one way or another, what would that look like? George Bush has his own proposal. There's the UN process that Mr. Schellenhuber says you've got to get to be part of, but Bush hasn't committed to that.
Well, I would anticipate that at the end of this first step that we can hope to use the phrase you use, that the leaders can come out holding hands, even if they're not dancing together yet. This is not going to be blocking productive talks. It's going to perhaps facilitate a sensible, effective set of talks for the post-Kyoto period. I think what we can look forward to then is the beginning of a structure of an architecture. And I really mean a basic architecture, like you might describe a house as being a center entrance colonial or a ranch. So just the basic architecture of how we should set up the post-Kyoto International Agreement. And some basic principles I think they can agree on. They should agree that it's going to be scientifically sound, economically rational, and politically pragmatic. I mean, if it's not economically sound, then of course it can't be economically rational, and it has to be economically rational in order to be politically pragmatic. And that's the point from which they should start. And if they start with that, then they can begin to establish some principles, I think, for the framework itself.
It sounds so cool and rational, and yet we know it quickly gets into all kinds of conflicting interests here. Emma Duncan, Robert Stavins, Hans-Joachim Schellenhuber. We take calls on this show. Herr Schellenhuber, I want to turn to one right now. Calling in from Roanoke, Virginia, Jay is calling from Interstate 81. Truck driver Jay, you're on the air.
Good morning, Tom. How you doing this
Pretty
morning?
Good. What do you think, Jay?
Well, you're having a debate on whether Bush is sincere in his commitment to this. And what I'm going to use is a biblical phrase to help people get a grasp of what he's actually committed to. The Bible says that where your treasure is, there your heart will be also.
Mm.
So if you watch where this man starts committing his money to, that's going to tell you exactly where his heart is committed. Is he truthfully in this or not?
Well, what if some American businessmen are now saying, we've got to settle this, or we don't know how to plan for the future. Is that where his or our treasure is in the economy?
Well, I mean, you have to look at where this man is going to start investing his money. Is he going to continue to invest his money in oil? Is it going to be in weaponry for the war? Or is he going to invest it in things that are going to be good for the environment?
Jay, you raise a point that takes us right to core interests. Robert Stavins, how do you see it? You can look at the president's interest, where his treasure lies, however we define that sort of biblical poetry, or the nation's treasure, where that lies. You know, do you see this White House or Washington now really believing that, let's say, America's treasure, or economy at least at this point, depends on getting this right?
I think that it's clear to members of the Congress, and it's clear to some people in the administration, and I hope it becomes clear to the president, that if a domestic policy is carried out in a sensible way, such as a cap-and-trade system, the way we address acid rain in the United States, that it lowers the cost to everyone involved, that then, in fact, we don't have to immediately abandon coal resources. We can gradually increase the price, essentially, of carbon dioxide, eventually bringing on technologies such as carbon capture and storage, continue to use coal resources, as was discussed here in the MIT report, and begin to move into the new era with technological change so that emission reductions can take place without the great sacrifice to the economy that I think everyone wants to avoid.
Mm. Hans-Joachim Schellenhuber, in Potsdam, Germany, we just saw news out of China over the weekend saying that they have their own plan on global warming and that China rejects mandatory caps on greenhouse gases. If China won't come in here, will the U.S.? And if neither of them will, well, is that the end of this?
I mean, the natural sequence really is for the United States first to come on board and then China and India to follow. I mean, if you just look, I'm a climate scientist myself. I mean, if you just look at the historic emissions over time, really, since the 1950s, when China and India have still a long way to go until they have to reduce their emissions. It's really the industrialized countries which have to take the lead. So you cannot simply point to China and do nothing. It's really the United States that have to resume global leadership on that. By the way, I'd like to comment on the economics or the economic argument here.
Yes.
I think it's absolutely pivotal here. I mean, the Europeans here are sort of supporting ambitious climate protection goals, not simply because they are so altruistic people. We will have to transform the world energy system anyway, just Professor Stevens has just said. We are standing at, or we are seeing the dawn of a new industrial revolution. I'm absolutely convinced about it. And you simply have to be one of the first movers. You have to make the right investments, because in the end, we will all run out of oil. So it's not just about climate protection. It's about energy security. It's about energy independence. Very important in Europe. We are depending a lot of Russian gas right now. So it's really that many European leaders, but also the European business people, have simply understood if they invest now into a carbon-free or low-carbon industry development, they will be better off and they will be much more competitive on the global market in the future. We're absolutely convinced about
it. And it's about who moves first and who moves together. Let me take a call from Saranac Lake, New York. Frank, you're on the air.
Good day and guten Tag. How are you, gentlemen?
Guten Tag, Frank. What do you see?
I absolutely agree with the point the speaker just made about whoever gets moved first is going to be the best off in the future. I just heard a statistic that it takes 1.5 million barrels of oil per year just to make the water bottles for the plastic that America drinks.
To carry around our little spring water bottles everywhere.
That's right.
Oh, my gosh.
And, I mean, that's just the water bottles. I think it's going to have to come to a point where we start passing laws for people to govern their behavior. With the mass consumerism and consumption that America has and the rest of the world is following their lead, we're killing people in the world to secure oil. I see a terrible momentum that's not changing. And until we start to address the excesses of civilization, we can't hope to make any progress in this. I'd like to listen to your discussion off the phone.
Great. Frank, thanks for raising that. Emma Duncan, how about it? We in the U.S. are just a few years off of our SUV craze of giant automobiles and still not completely off that. Is Europe popularly girding for real changes in lifestyle to accompany the kind of, you know, big government plans we're talking about here?
Well, I think you do begin to see changes happening in Europe. And, you know, interestingly, to support Hans Jochem's point, the largest renewable energy company in the world in terms of market cap is a Danish wind energy company called Vestas. Mm. It is not a coincidence that Denmark has been promoting wind energy for longer than anyone else. You know, that country's renewable energy companies have an advantage in the world market now.
And so real advantages there with the first mover status. Mr. Schellenhuber, what about it? Our American caller says, you know, we're going to have to change our lifestyle in dramatic ways. Is Europe prepared to do that? Are you already on the road? Do you believe you'll have to?
It's not all about lifestyle. It's about lifestyle as well. I mean, I changed to a much more efficient car recently. Yeah? So you have to make your contributions. But in the end, it's all about structural innovation, really, I think. I mean, I'm often in the United States. I'm a member of the U.S. Academy of Sciences and often go to, for example, Arizona State University. They have a lot of sun in Arizona, you know, and we are not using it. But the funny thing is that some 10 years ago, Germany imported a lot of technology, photovoltaics and so on, solar thermal, from Arizona and has developed it further here in Europe. And now we see Arizonan companies coming to us and watching what we have done with it.
Mr. Schellenhuber, thanks very much for joining us. Let's take a call from Cedar Rapids, Iowa, and Simon. Simon, you're on the air.
Hi. Afternoon. How are you guys?
We're good. What do you see, Simon?
Well, I was just going to say that maybe we're giving George Bush a little too much credit and a little too much power at this point, since the impact he's made on the environment, at least in the United States, has already happened. And he can't do much more damage than he's already done. And the decisions he makes now, even at the G8 summit, may be moot at this point, because in a year and a half he'll be gone and somebody else can make some better decisions, maybe.
Maybe, but we've got still 2 years nearly of the president in power. I mean, given the kind of TikTok menace that we're told global warming now represents, doesn't every two-year unit matter, Simon?
Oh, I think it does matter, but I don't know if you're going to be able to find anything different from this president than he's already given you. It took him 6 years to be convinced that there wasn't a global warming crisis to begin with, so I'm not sure you can convince him at this point with his investment in oil and his friends that kind of back big business.
There's the skepticism right from the middle of America. Let's get a call from Jamaica Plain, Massachusetts. Bill, you're on the air.
Yes, thanks for taking my call, Tom. Mm-hmm. Now, Chancellor Merkel is from the former East Germany. And having visited East Germany myself,
Well, her country includes the former East Germany. What did you see there?
No, I know, but she certainly understands what an ecologically damaged country looks like.
Yes.
I was there myself in the 80s, and it was a tremendous ecological mess. So I guess my question and comment is, you know, the Europeans have a long memory, and as your previous caller just stated, it's taken Bush this long to even acknowledge that there is a greenhouse gas problem. How can the Europeans take him seriously?
All right, let's pick it straight up. Robert Stavins, how about it? I mean, you can understand that question.
It's true that the Europeans certainly have, if not skepticism, they have in their minds giving a lack of credibility to the president and the administration. But it's also true that they recognize that in the United States, the Congress is moving forward, that there are diverse views within the administration, and in fact, that another president will be coming along. And in the meantime, much can be accomplished in terms of setting us on the right path with our international partners in discussions. I think that's the opportunity that's there now. It's not to solve the problem. It's not to waltz out of the room to the music, but it is to begin to hold hands.
Now, the United States did not get into the Kyoto Agreement in part because it didn't include China, India, other developing nations. Now President Bush says he wants them in. China is so far officially saying no, or at least we're not going to agree to any caps on greenhouse gas emissions, though the U.S. hasn't yet either. Is there a hope that China and India will, for just to take two, will join in here, or are they in a position simply to say, no way, why should we slow down our development after you guys polluted the whole planet to get rich yourselves?
With the right kind of structure for an international agreement, I think that there is hope. In fact, we have to have hope, because without China and India, given the rate at which China alone is building coal-fired power plants every week, then there's no hope for addressing climate change.
And I read
them.
That by 2009 or 10, China will eclipse the United States as the biggest greenhouse gas emitter.
By some estimates, in terms of carbon dioxide, they'll eclipse us this year, in fact, this calendar year. Mm. And the developing world as a whole will eclipse what is now the industrialized world within a few years after that. So that's what industrialization is all about. So all key countries have to be involved, not just the limited set of countries that were in the Kyoto Protocol. And it's for several reasons. I mean, the first one is what we were just saying. Namely, there's this rapid economic growth, which we applaud in the developing world. But beyond that, that's where the low-cost emission reductions are now, because of the fact that those economies are less energy efficient. Now, a lot of people would still say, including some of the callers, and I understand this, well, gee, the United States and the industrialized world should go first. After all these excessive emissions and concentrations that are already up there, they're the result of industrialization. By definition, they're a result of the industrialized countries. But there's an unfortunate reality. There is an inconvenient truth. And the inconvenient truth here is that if a narrow coalition of countries takes action on global climate change without the developing countries, then we will have the effect unintentionally of essentially relocating the production of carbon-intensive goods and services, shifting comparative advantage economically in the production of carbon-intensive goods and services outside of the coalition.
Even faster. You mean because every dirty producer in the world will just relocate to China or India where they can belch? No, not every, but enough that you got a problem.
Principally in manufacturing. Electricity cannot relocate, but manufacturing certainly can. And we push them onto a more carbon-intensive growth path than they otherwise would be, which is precisely the opposite of what we ought to be doing. So they need to be on the global climate policy train. But that doesn't mean that we can expect them to pay for it. Because, as you said, to expect them to pay at this point would be tantamount to not allowing them to have their economic development.
So someone else is going to pay for it? I mean, China has $1 trillion in U.S. debt already. We're going to ship barrels of cash to China to get them to put in more efficient, I don't know, washing machines, factory smokestack scrubbers?
Not shipping barrels of cash, but with the right kind of international agreement, what are called growth targets, so that the countries such as China, India, and the other key developing countries take on targets for climate change, so we eliminate this emissions leakage problem that I was just describing.
That is, factories moving
to
dirty zones.
And therefore the emissions moving.
Right, right.
We eliminate that, and yet it's a growth target. So their target becomes more stringent as
economic
they become
growth
more wealthy.
Or
linked
or
to growth. Linked to economic growth.
So emissions growth constraints somehow tied up with economic growth numbers.
That's right. And you link that with an international cap and trade program, And the result can be, since there are lower cost emissions reductions in those countries,
yes,
where you'll see the flow of permits and the flow of investments is going to be to the developing countries.
Mm-hmm.
That's the hook to get them involved, it can give them investment.
It gets to be a dense thicket in a hurry, but yet we
yes.
know this really matters. Emma Duncan, let me ask you about Europe. Is Europe ready to go ahead without China and India, for that matter, without the United States, even though on its own it clearly cannot solve the global climate change?
Well, Europe has gone ahead already. Having signed up to Kyoto,
it's
established a cap and trade program. We have a carbon price in Europe. And, you know, this is what the whole business of trying to establish a carbon regime is about. It's about setting a price on emitting carbon to discourage businesses from emitting carbon and thus encourage cleaner technologies to develop. So Europe's done it. There are costs associated with it, though many people would argue not enormous ones. But Europe has done it, and it has seen results in terms of, if you like, moral pressure on the rest of the world. If Europe hadn't done it, certainly Bush wouldn't have made this move. It may not be a fantastically substantial move, but it's a big advance on where he was before. Australia is now talking about a cap and trade system. China is beginning to talk about climate change for the first time. California has legislated emissions targets.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there have been consequences from what Europe did. Many people at the time said it's completely pointless. You know, all you're doing is loading costs on your own economy. It's going to have no effect at all. Actually, politically, it has had some effect.
Let me ask you, though, some skeptics of Europe in America would say, well, it was easier for Europe to control emissions growth, let's say, because Europe's economy just grows more slowly. We've got a big, robust economy in this country, and it brings emissions along with it. Do you have to take a lower growth path in order to, well, save the environment?
Well, actually, Europe's economy is growing pretty much at the same rate as America's now. No, I don't think that the costs are that enormous. For instance, if you look at the figures calculated recently by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which is the body the UN set up to achieve some sort of consensus on the economics and the science of this, looking ahead, it reckons that you can stabilize carbon dioxide equivalent concentrations in the atmosphere at a reasonably stable, safe level by the end of this century, at a cost of something like 0.1% of GDP growth a year.
Mm-hmm.
So that means that if the world economy would have grown at 2.5% a year, if you adopt the sort of carbon price they reckon is needed, it would grow instead by 2.4% a year.
Sounds manageable.
Huge. Mm.
Let's take a call from San Diego, California. John, you're on the air.
One comment I'd like to make is, you know, just looking past the presidential administration right now, in a article published in the Time magazine about Al Gore's last temptation, even if he wasn't running, he was at 16% approved to be, most likely be president. But even then, somebody who's taking leadership like Al Gore and trying to look past the politics and trying to get to the very top issue of global warming, I mean, somebody like him to take leadership and take it past the 4-year, 8-year mark, if we have a president that somebody who's just like that, who's got the hopes and dreams of, you know, of America to take the stand on.
But John, let me ask you, Al Gore's not in the race. Are you confident that those who are in the race, whether it's a Democrat or a Republican, you know, is Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama or Rudy Giuliani or Mitt Romney, John McCain, are you confident that any of them, all of them, will address this with equal aggressiveness because they've got to? Are we guaranteed of a whole new world post-George Bush or not?
In those presidential candidates, I believe not, because it would take somebody who already has a base supporter of people who are pro global warming, trying to get rid of that issue.
John, thanks for calling. Robert Stavins, what about it? Are you so confident that circumstances will push the next American administration to aggressive action on climate change or not?
I think that circumstances in terms of world scientific opinion, you know, I served myself as a lead author on this intergovernmental panel on climate change that was just mentioned, that scientific opinion.
The UN panel that Angela Merkel wants everything to be funneled through ultimately.
That's correct. Scientific opinion as well as international political opinion and domestic politics is going to lead the next president and the next Congress to enact domestic legislation and to participate in international agreement. That's why Joe Aldi from Resources for the Future and myself put together this book, Architectures for Agreement, because we think what's inevitably going to happen is we're going to have to decide what the future international agreement is going to be.
Will the U.S. agree to put a price on carbon, as Emma Duncan points? This is the bottom line. If the government doesn't step in to put some price on these emissions, you can't give business a clear picture of the future, and you can't really stop the problem.
Yeah, I agree with Emma Duncan 100%. What's absolutely needed is a price signal and a long-term price signal. So not simply a cap-and-trade program for the short term, for 2008 to 2012. I applaud the EU emissions trading scheme, but it's not going to be sufficient. We need a long-term program there and in the United States.
But are the real interests lined up to accept even promote that? I mean, whether it's industry or oil or, the big money interests that put a lot of money into politicians' pockets, are they lined up to accept that now?
They are lined up to not only to accept it, but they are already beginning to strategize about how to compete for the allocation of the permits. That's the degree to which they recognize that it's happening, at least in the United States.
So they see it coming. Let me take a call from West Newbury, Massachusetts. Gillian, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Yes.
I'm an Australian-American and grew up in Brisbane, where General MacArthur was based during the Second World War.
Pip, pip.
And we in Australia have, actually, I'm an Australian-American now, so I've thrown in my lot with this country.
Okay, so what do you think?
I just want to congratulate the international people on your panel, the German man and the English woman, for their restraint in the light of, what has always chafed in the rest of the world, the American arrogance. We think of all these things first, and we are going to be first, and we're going to run the show. And
well, we clearly didn't think of this one first, but do you think America should lead on this now, or can lead on this now?
I believe only, if the rest of the world lets it, and they must, because we are so powerful, but I would just love to see America do it with some humility, with some sense of, you guys are showing us the way. I'd like there to be an acknowledgement to Europe, and particularly Germany and England, where they have really developed lots and lots of stuff.
Right. Point taken, and our time is short, but let us pick that up. Emma Duncan, part of what had sparks flying a couple of weeks ago, as I understand it, was the White House rejection of Merkel's plan was so blunt. It was so interface. They just said, this is crossing red lines for us. We're not doing what you're proposing, period. With that kind of attitude, is Europe still open to America coming in? Does it have any choice because America is such a big polluter?
No, Europe doesn't have any choice. And yes, public sparks do fly over that kind of thing. But Europe is desperately keen to have its movement on this issue, its early movement on this issue, validated by America following it. And frankly, if America wants to claim moral leadership in the future, fine by me, so long as it does something.
And bring that on. Robert Stavins, what about it? As we watch this from the sidelines, how will we, as citizens who aren't environment experts, how will we know when and if this thing's getting on the right track, the environment is headed toward a better future?
I think one of the ways that we'll recognize that the international discussions are getting onto the right track is when they move beyond some of the real problems that the Kyoto Protocol brought about and the divisions they brought about between the United States and our European friends.
So unity itself is one signal.
I think that that's right. And the big one is simply this, is that the Kyoto Protocol has a baseline year of 1990. That turns out to be extremely important. Because
that is taking emissions back to the levels of that year.
Or they're relative to that year,
yes.
In some cases below that
yes,
year.
Okay.
But it it's all based on that. The United States had unparalleled growth in the 1990s. Mm-hmm. Many of your listeners will think of those as the Clinton years.
Yes, right.
And remarkable growth, 35% increase in GDP. That means an increase in CO2 emissions.
So can we make it back there? Because Europe didn't have as big a growth during that decade.
And they had reunification of Germany, which brought the fall in emissions. Mm-hmm. So we're going to have to change that baseline. It's just one of the things that we'll have to change is moving the baseline forward.
Can you change the baseline and save the planet? We thought we had to go back there.
Absolutely. The target can be anything. We can take Chancellor Merkel's target, but do it on a different baseline.
We're going to have to be flexible, and I guess we're going to have to be ambitious at the same time. Emma Duncan with The Economist magazine in London. Thanks for your great work there, and thanks for your time. Terrific to have you with us this hour. Emma, thanks for joining us.
Thanks very much.
And Robert Stavins, look for his book coming out this fall, Architectures for Agreement. Professor Stavins, you're terrific. Thanks a lot for being with us today.
My pleasure, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.